Hey everybody, nice to see you all, a pleasure. It's afternoon here, but now later and later afternoon as the season turns. Maybe it's evening where you are. And it's I would like to begin by saying that I'm very happy today because I'm happy that there is a ceasefire or an end to the war in Israel-Palestine, Gaza. I'm really happy that the guns and the bombs are silent. There are no more bombs falling, no more guns being shot off. I'm really happy that all the living hostages are home and that prisoners who were in jails are freed from jails. And days ago, everybody was really rejoicing about all this. Today also, in Judaism, was a very joyful day, a holiday called Simcha Torah, which is the day that you finish reading the Torah. You know, you read the Torah on an annual cycle, and today's the day that you finish reading it so that you can start over again. So I actually went to the synagogue today where we read a very sad death of Moses, which is how the Torah ends. After all of that happened, Moses dies, very sad. And then the next thing is, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. So that's how it goes, right? You end and you start over again, and you end and you start over again. And it's a joyous occasion where you take all the Torahs out of the ark, and you march around the room and you dance and you're very joyful. And they always have whiskey, even though it's in the morning. You know, they have whiskey, and you have to drink whiskey. So I had to drink whiskey, and I'm not very good at drinking whiskey, I have to say. Has a big impact on me so early in the morning, but that was my duty, you know, so I had to do that. Anyway, nobody knows how long this peace will last. Nobody knows what the next steps are to ensure that it will last. I have seen some potentially hopeful signs, but many more signs that are not hopeful. And as you have read, I'm sure our president went to Israel, where he was received with tremendous adulation, and he gave an unbelievable aspirational speech about peace, where he said that there will be eternal peace in the Holy Land for all time under God. And this is the one speech that he gave, at least that part of it that I'm aware of, that I really felt good about. I was happy to feel good about his speech, because I would like to see peace unto eternity in the Holy Land. That would be great. Next month, in November, we're actually going to put the Gandhavyuha Sutra to bed, just like in the synagogue. We're going to finish one thing and start another thing, so we're going to finish this at the end of this month and start reading next month the Dhammapada. And I think that in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says something like, peace leads to peace and violence leads to violence. And that seems very, very true. But it is possible, I think, that terrible violence and this that happened in Gaza could scarcely be more terrible. That terrible violence can sometimes, let's hope, exhaust itself and lead to a thought of peace, because it's just so horrendous that it's just too much. And then that thought of peace can lead to more thoughts of peace, because people can see that this is futile. It goes on and on. How long can we go on with this? And so then that thought of peace can rise up from the ashes and create more and more thoughts of peace. And peace can become a reality rising out of the ashes of violence. hoping against hope for that. I think that it's possible to think that in the big, big, big picture of things, and goodness knows in the Gandhavyuha we are being conditioned to the big, big, big picture of things. But I think it's possible that throughout history, people have always gotten the rulers that they truly wanted and needed, even when they had no part whatsoever in choosing them, which is most of history. People never chose their rulers. But even when they didn't choose them, they got the leaders that they needed and wanted, because maybe the leaders were a projection of the collective hearts of everyone. So in that sense, maybe you can look at what happens in the world. And I really think that the Buddha looked at it like this, not as the fault of this or that person or group of persons, but as the sum total of what all of us are and what all of us want, whether we know it or not. And because we are not very mature, we have seen a messed up world, you know. We made messes. But we're getting better, you know, we're growing up. Aren't we all here trying to grow up? Isn't that what our practice is about, trying to become grown-ups finally in this world? And isn't this really what the Gandhavyuha is saying? If you think about what this sutra is saying, it's saying that we are all growing up toward awakening, and that the whole of reality is animated by awakening. That's what reality really is, and that's what's spurring us on. And that the world is full of spiritual benefactors for us to visit and be helped by. And it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time. So this always cheers me up. And even in the darkest times, I have a lot of confidence in that. Yesterday was a very weird weather day here at Muir Beach. It was rainy and windy, and the sky was full of clouds. And then for a little while, the clouds broke up and they became gorgeous, big, bright, cumulus clouds with very sharply etched edges. And they were so beautiful that I had to stop everything else that I was doing and just sit outside and watch the clouds for a considerable amount of time. And they were very active. They were moving all over the place, lots of them. And I thought to myself, these are very, very meaningful clouds. They seem to have so much meaning. And then I thought, what am I talking about? What does that mean? Meaningful clouds. How could there be meaningful clouds? And then I thought, well, what is meaning anyway, to begin with? And I really didn't know. And I thought to myself, well, what I guess it means to me is that there is so much presence in these clouds. They're just bursting with presence, so grand, so rich. And they just filled my heart completely. I couldn't think about anything else. And I'm sure that all of you know exactly what I mean. And this is the universe that the Gandhavyuha is describing. A world that is bursting full of emotion and meaning. A world as a child sees it. A world in which even the terrible things that happen are like part of a big picture, like almost like a fairy tale or a fable, that's always moving and developing, and it's always going, as tragic as it can be, in the direction of awakening. And all the Buddhas and spiritual benefactors that Sudana meets, with their immense practices that go beyond all conceptions of time and space and activity, are just indications that there is so much to this human life, to this human mind, so much more than we can see when we go around with our heads down and our eyes down and we forget to look up at the sky. Well, I can't remember. It's only a week ago, and I can't remember exactly what we talked about last time and exactly what we read. I know there were a number of different readers, and I lost track. And I keep, it's hard to, you know, remember where you are in this sutra. It's kind of like being in a dream, you know, you don't know where you are half the time. And so it's easy to get lost in it, and I've been getting lost in it the whole time. But in case I didn't get to this last time, and perhaps I did, so I can't remember now, but I don't think I did. I had there's one thing I wanted to say about the goddess Sutejo Mandala Ratishri that we talked about last time, and I don't think I said this, and I did want to say this. She's the benefactor who comes before Gopi, and Gopi is the one who comes before Queen Maya, which we're always aware of her, who is the 41st benefactor. And this one is a goddess from Lumbini. Remember we talked about Lumbini has to do with Buddha's birth because he was born in Lumbini. And she is, her subject, one of the things that she talks about a lot in her section is taking birth into the great family of the Buddhas. And this is something that bodhisattvas do, enlightening beings, all at some stage of their development, are born into the family of the Buddhas. So they actually become like relatives of the Buddha, heirs of the Buddha. And so becoming an heir of the Buddha, like literally being in the Buddhist family line, is an important stage on the bodhisattva path. And what I wanted to say last time that I believe I forgot to say is that this is really a very important aspect of our tradition. Maybe uniquely in the Buddhist world, I'm not sure. We are, in our tradition, supposedly, supposed to be, little by little, as we develop in practice, actually becoming members of the Buddhist family. So it's more than that we're following the Buddhist teaching, we think it's a very good teaching, and we're putting it into practice. No, it's more than that. We're actually becoming heirs of the Buddha. We're like becoming Buddha's bloodline. And in the Jukai ceremony, Jukai, which means receiving precepts, of course we emphasize precepts, as we should, but precepts are not just precepts. They are considered the actual blood that flows through the Buddha's veins. The precepts are understood to be the blood that flows through the Buddha's veins, the Buddha's very life. And that's why, in our tradition, because we receive more than precepts, we receive the precepts, but that's why we receive also a new name, because that's the Buddha family name. And we also receive a document that probably most of us don't pay that much attention to, but I pay a lot of attention to it because I have to make those documents, called Kechimyaku. And Kechimyaku means blood vein. And the document says on the front, blood vein. And it shows all the generations from the Buddha to you. And your name is on that document. The red line that connects all the generations from the Buddha all the way through to you. And the red line is blood, it's life, and it's the precepts that are impossible to keep and impossible not to keep. Actually, in all our rituals, we are expressing our family relationship to the Buddha. We're actually disentangling ourselves from our ordinary family relationships, leaving that lineage in a sense, although of course we never leave it, but we transform it, leaving that lineage in a sense and entering the lineage of the Buddhas, entering the Buddha's family. And although you could say that, well, this is metaphorical and it's symbolic, but it doesn't really feel like it's metaphorical and symbolic or poetic or something like that. It feels very immediately real, I can tell you. And I'll never forget, long years ago when I was studying Buddhism a lot, much more than I do now, I was really studying a lot Buddhism, and I remember being so amazed to find that the early Buddhists, you know, not that many generations after the Buddhist time, believed that an actual physical change came about when a person received precepts and joined the Buddhist family, that they somehow, like, literally became a different kind of a being, or a different physical change took place. Something in their DNA shifted. Although, of course, they didn't know about DNA, but they thought that something in the DNA shifted and they became different. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, now that they have like very, very exacting science, I wouldn't be surprised at all if in the future somebody figured out that that was literally true. That when you took the precepts, you literally, physically had a DNA shift. I wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, I don't think I told you about that last week, and I wanted to mention that. I don't think I say anything anymore that I haven't already said dozens of times. So those of you who have been hanging around me, you've heard me say that before. Okay, now we get to the next benefactor, who is Gopi, as I said. And Gopi is not a goddess, not a Buddha. She's like an ordinary, not so ordinary, Shakyan girl, meaning from the clan of Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is from the Shakya clan. And she lives in Kapilavastu, where the Buddha lived. And this time, I think this is not the first time, but it might be the second or third time, that there's a new pattern in the encounter. Usually, Sudana finds the benefactor and then immediately at the beginning asks him or her the question, and then she or he gives the teachings. But this time there's a slight difference in the pattern of the encounter. Before Sudana finds Gopi, he is visited by a goddess whose name is Sorrowless. That's a nice name for a goddess, don't you think? Sorrowless. Who is not alone, of course. She comes with 10,000 other goddesses. And these are all goddesses from the meeting hall where the enlightening beings have their meetings. So there's apparently a meeting hall over there in Kapilavastu where all the enlightening beings hang out, like a clubhouse or something. And it has 10,001 goddesses. So they come to Sudana, and before Sudana even meets Gopi, they heap praises on Sudana for his dedication and his tireless desire to save all beings, unstinting in his compassion. And so Sudana says, well, thank you very much for praising me. And yes, it's true, bodhisattvas are very dedicated and very tireless, and they never stop in their efforts for beings. And when after that, the goddess and her 10,000 assistants throw flowers on him and make offerings to him, and then they recite for him a lot of wonderful poems. So that happens before he meets Gopi, and finally he goes into the meeting hall and he sees Gopi, and Gopi teaches him the 10 practices to attain universal knowledge and the 10 ways that one should approach and make offerings to enlightening beings. He then asks her about the scope of her attainment, and she tells him about the scope of her attainment, and that telling goes on for many, many pages. But there's just one paragraph in it that I just seemed really amusing and amazing to me. So I'm going to read you that paragraph. And in this text, it's on page 281. It's about, if you go to the teacher Gopi in your text, it's about, let's see how many pages in. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 8 pages in, because we have to have the 10,000 goddesses before he gets to Gopi. So now Gopi has been telling her the extent of her practice. And she says this on the top of 281, page 281 in my text. Just as I penetrate the various oceans of ages past in this world, in the same way I know the endless, unbroken succession of ages in the future. And just as I know all this in this world, so do I know it all in all the worlds within this world. And just as I know this in all the worlds within this world, so do I know it in all the worlds in the atoms of this world. So this world has many worlds within it, and within those many worlds there are atoms. Each atom also has many worlds within it. And just as I know it in all the worlds in the atoms of this world, so do I know it in the worlds in the 10 directions contiguous with this world. And just as I know it in the worlds in the 10 directions contiguous with this world, so do I know it in all the worlds in the 10 directions surrounding this world. And just as I know it in all the worlds in the 10 directions surrounding this world, so do I know it in all the worlds in the radiant world system of Vairochana. And just as I know it in all the worlds in the radiant world system of Vairochana, I know it in all the worlds surrounding the radiant world system of Vairochana. And just as I know it in all the worlds surrounding the radiant world system of Vairochana, I know it in all the places in the worlds, in the oceans of worlds, in the masses of worlds, in this whole flower treasury universe, and in all the structures and features of all those worlds. So her knowledge is quite extensive. And the world is very, very extensive. Let's not be fooled by the smallness of the world as it appears to us. Then, as he had asked the other benefactors, he asks Gopi, well, how long ago? Remember, at some point, this new element got introduced where he began asking all the benefactors, how long ago have you achieved this wonderful liberation? And then they tell their backstory, and the backstory is always pretty fantastic. But this time, I want to go into this backstory because I really thought this was a very charming backstory, because it's a tender and beautiful love story. And there's nothing like a love story, right? Don't we all love a love story? So here is her backstory. Once long ago, and far away, there was a world called Producing Fearlessness. And in that world, there was an age called Superior Conduct. And in that age, and in that world of four continents, there was a city called Magnificent Trees. And that city, Magnificent Trees, was the greatest of the 84 billion cities in that world of four continents. And in that magnificent city, there was a king named Lord of Wealth. And he had a queen named Lotus Born. And they had a son named Lord of Glory, who, as you can imagine, was very, very handsome and about as talented as a person could be. At that time, there was a courtesan named Beautiful, who had a daughter named Splendor of Delight in Virtuous Conduct. And of course, every world has to have a Buddha, So there was a Buddha in this world named Supreme Sun, S-U-N, Supreme Sun. And it happened to be that at this time, that Buddha had just awakened. And this is the special time, you know, the days, first days and the first blush of a Buddha's awakening are really wonderful. So that's what time it was. It was a time of just after the awakening in the park. There was a park where the Buddha had awakened under the tree, and everybody was there, including Splendor of the Light and Virtuous Conduct, who had before that had a beautiful dream. Splendor of the Light and Virtuous Conduct, remember, is Beautiful's beautiful, talented daughter, who before the Buddha's awakening had a dream about him and went to see him there in the park. And guess what? Who was there in the park but the prince, the very handsome young prince, Lord of Glory, and immediately they fell in love. But it wasn't without its problems, because the problem was that both of them had great virtue and a desire to become enlightened beings on a quest for omniscience. And so it was not so clear how that was going to work out with, you know, the romance. Was that incompatible, maybe, you know? So this was a bit of a problem. As is often the case in these matters, it was the young woman who was most certain about what should happen and how she felt about it all. And when they first met, she recited these verses on page 185 in my text, a few pages beyond. And these are some of the verses that she recited to the young man. "When I saw you, young man, excellent in form and strength, endowed with virtue, all my senses were delighted, and immense joy arose in me. Your complexion is like a pure shining jewel. Your hair is black and curly. You have a fine brow and nose. I offer myself to you. You have excellent features, resplendent. You are like a mountain of gold. In your presence, I do not shine. I am like a pile of charcoal. Your eyes are large and dark. Your jaw is like a lion's. Your face like the full moon. The fine sound of your voice is irresistible. Please take me in. Your tongue is long and broad, coppery red, soft, shining like a jewel. With your superb, clear voice, you delight people when you speak. Your teeth are even, shining white, clean and well-spaced. When you show them as you smile, you delight people. Oh, hero. Your body has the 32 marks of greatness, brilliantly shining, pure, adorned with them. You will become a sovereign ruler of men." The prince then, in return, recites a bunch of verses, inquiring, who is this beautiful person, and is she as virtuous as she is beautiful? And then, as often happens in these cases, the mother is nearby, and she speaks up with many verses attesting to her daughter's extraordinary goodness, starting with the amazing fact that the daughter was not born in the ordinary way. She was born spontaneously in the calyx of a lotus flower, and born on exactly the same morning that the prince was born. And she goes on in praise to praise in verse the many virtues and characteristics of her very special daughter. And here is a little excerpt from some of the things she says a couple pages later. And this is now the courtesan, beautiful, speaking about her daughter. "All her limbs are like pure jewels. She radiates an aura of light, adorned by the virtues she has accomplished. She is fit to be your companion. She knows the causes of all illnesses that afflict living beings. and she is able to cure them by correct use of medicines. So she's a top-notch doctor, too. So everybody wants to marry a doctor, right? She has mastered all the different languages of the people on the continent and the variety of customary usages of society everywhere. She knows the articulation of sounds and the means of differentiation among them, and she is expert in all the songs and dances of the whole world. She's not jealous or envious. She's not lustful or ill-tempered. She's taciturn, honest, and gentle, free from anger and harshness, very intelligent. She is diligent, well-behaved, not argumentative, always obedient to the worthy. She is respectful, seeking to do whatever is good. She will do as you ask. She is always compassionate toward the elderly, toward the sick and the poor, toward the suffering, the blind, and toward the helpless. She is always thinking of the welfare of others, and she never thinks of benefit for herself, seeking the welfare of the whole world. She is adorned with superior virtues of mind. She is never careless, always mindful and aware, whether standing, sitting, reclining, or walking, whether silent or speaking, she is always remembered and honored. In short, dear prince, she is fit to be your bride. She says that to the prince. So then the prince says, well, the trouble is, I have set out for supreme perfect enlightenment, whereby I may gather the infinite stores of omniscience, cultivate the practices of enlightening beings for infinite eons, and perfect all the transcendent ways. And as I practice this total relinquishment, I have to give away everything inside and out. I have to give away my sons, my daughters, and my wife. I have to give up my eyes, my head, my hands, my feet. And should we get together, it might hinder my giving. And then you would become unhappy at the relinquishment of our beloved children, and you would feel much physical and mental pain. You would resent my determination to give up everything. When I lop off my limbs and give them to beggars, you would be pained and grieved by this. And there will come a time when I leave you to go forth into the tutelage of a Buddha, and at that time you will really be unhappy. So this does seem like a bit of a problem. So he's nice there. He doesn't want to just go ahead and rush into this without letting her know the real issues involved, right? Which I think always a good idea, right, in a relationship. Let people know, well, here's the way I actually am. She then replies to this. He says, by the way, I forgot, he also recites verses, the end of which, though, he says at the end, after he says, you will be grieved and all this, he says, yet I want you. Hear my aim, and if you do not despair, all shall be as you wish. So he's just saying, like, okay, I really love you too, but I want you to know the truth of who I am, and if you can handle it, then yes, let's get together. And she then replies to him, even if my body should be burnt to death in the fires of hell, I would endure it for myriad lifetimes as your companion in practice. Even if life after life, for endless lives, my body were cut asunder, I would endure it with a steadfast mind if you were my husband. Even if the mountain should crush my head for endless ages, I would endure it unfazed if you become my husband. In infinite lifetimes, you may cut off your own limbs and give them to others. Lead me to control of my thoughts and make me firm in my duty. I give you my body completely, O Prince of Men. Performing spiritual practice for myriad ages, give me to whoever wants me and I will be happy. You have set out for supreme enlightenment with infinite compassion for beings. Having taken all beings into your care, take me in too with compassion. It is not for enjoyment of wealth or sensual pleasure that I want you, best of men, for my husband, but to share the same spiritual practice. So, isn't that great? They're on the same page. And they realize that the only way they can really get together is based on their mutual vow for spiritual practice. And so, it's okay. So together, off they go to visit the Buddha's Supreme Son. And the Buddha, who understands their aspiration, spontaneously creates on the spot a scripture called Lamp at the Door of the Universal Eye. And they listen to this scripture and they totally get it. And upon hearing it, they gain the 10 oceans of concentrations. And that's when the father of the prince, the king, is so inspired to see this that he decided to abdicate his throne and study with the Buddha. And this is the part that Marianne, she was very enthusiastic about this part, and she read us this section last week. And that meant that the prince became the new king, and he had amazing accomplishments on behalf of many, many sentient beings. He was a great king. And he invited the Buddha Supreme Son to all of the billion cities, 84 billion cities in his realms. The Buddha Supreme Son visited every one of them. And everywhere he went, of course, people were inspired to practice, and he awakened myriad beings, and everyone lived happily ever after. That's the end of the story. Isn't that a wonderful love story? I really like that story. Now, at the end of the story, this gopi, remember, is telling this story. And she says, now, who do you think was that prince? She said, that prince was Shakyamuni Buddha in a past life. And who do you think was that queen, Lotus, born in the story? And, of course, that queen was none other than Queen Maya. And who do you think was the daughter, Splendor of Delight in Virtuous Conduct? It was me. Gopi, that's who I was in a past life. And that's how come I got to be Gopi today, living inside the meeting house, the clubhouse of the enlightening beings. So the next benefactor after Gopi is Queen Maya. And I am not going to go into her story much. I think others might. But there is one thing that I do want to mention. And this is on page 308, which is, how many pages in? About three pages in to the story of Queen Maya. And this is not about Queen Maya, but this is about a supernatural being named Fine Eye, who was a doorkeeper of the clubhouse of the enlightening beings. So we have the goddesses, but now there's doorkeepers. So this is Fine Eye, the doorkeeper. And he also had 10,000 supernatural beings, who I guess were his assistant doorkeepers. And he also had a wife and a son and a whole clan. And they sprinkled Sudana with flowers of various colors and pleasant fragrances. And they said, an enlightening being imbued with 10 qualities, there's always 10 as we say, and to 10 qualities to approach spiritual friends. What are the 10 qualities? And the first one is a mind pure and free from guile and deceit. That's the first quality of the 10 qualities that you need to approach spiritual benefactors. And so I love that one. And that's why I picked that one out. And I just want to say a word about this. Because it just goes to show you that enlightening beings are not like ordinary persons in this way, in many ways, but in this way in particular that I want to point out. They are very naive and trusting all the time, innocent, free of any kind of strategizing or calculation or deceit. And they're only motivated by compassion and energy to go on with their practice and nothing else. And they look on all beings with kind eyes, with no suspicion and no cynicism. That's amazing, right? Wouldn't that be wonderful? I mean, think of all the burdens of having to be strategizing and cynical and worried about people all the time and what they might do to you and blah, blah. You know, that is so burdensome. How nice to be just totally guileless. Now, you might think, well, nice for them in all these Buddha realms, but, you know, in this realm, you can't be that way. I disagree. I think that we can be that way, or we can try to be that way anyway. We can practice toward that. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't see the world as it is. Enlightening beings, of course, see the world as it is. And the world as it is, really, when you think about it, is actually full of mostly, overwhelmingly decent and upstanding and trustworthy people. Most people are like that. Most people are pretty wonderful, especially if you give them a chance and you open up some space for them, then they'll really be that way. However, as we know, there are some people who are seen to be pretty mean-spirited and want to take advantage of you or advantage of other people. And to be sure, this world is full of all kinds of very twisted circumstances. So you can see all of that and be very clear about all that. But if you don't think of these things as characteristics of persons or of the world, but just as forces in the human heart that are part of the enlightening being's practice of omniscience and compassion, then I think it really is possible to see things clearly in their difficulty without pulling any punches about that, but at the same time, not react to the difficulty, but instead see through it into the fundamental goodness of things that is, of course, always there at the same time, if you could see through all that, to it. So I think it is possible, I really do, not to act on our various strategies of self-protection and self-aggrandizement, and actually behave in this world the way it is, like enlightening beings. Anyway, definitely it makes sense, I think, to aspire to this and to work on it, even though we might not be able to achieve it perfectly. I think it's very real and it's very possible, and I think that it's the way to really be happy. Maybe it's the only way to actually really be happy. And the reason why this is so important to me is because all my life I've been so amazed by Suzuki Roshi's use of the word sincere, which seemed always to me like such a bizarre word for this Japanese guy to be using when he didn't even know English very well. What did he mean when he was always talking about sincere practice? And I think this is what he meant. Sincere practice is just living your life as truly as you and honestly as you can, without guile, without strategizing, just doing what you do with an open heart all the time. Okay, so I'm almost finished. One last thing, though, as you know, I've noticed that to me, there's some things in the sutra that just are so delightful and so amazing. You just can't not share them, you know. So this is the part where Maya, this is in this Maya section, where it turns out that Maya is not only the mother of Buddha, she's the mother of all Buddhas that ever were and ever will be. And all these Buddhas are walking around in Maya's belly. So I'm going to just read you that part. Once all of them were in my belly, so this is infinite Buddhas, right? So this is Maya's belly. So those of you who have given birth, you can like project your mind back to that time when you were pregnant and imagine this. Once all of them were in my belly, they walked around in strides as big as a billion world universe, even as big as worlds as numerous as atoms in untold Buddha lands. And also all the untold congregations of enlightening beings at the feet of all the Buddhas in all worlds in the 10 directions entered my belly in every moment of thought to see the miracle of the enlightening beings dwelling in the womb. So not only were there all these Buddhas there, but everyone had to have all these witnesses who wanted to see this. All of them walking around in the poor lady's belly. The chief gods of all the heavens also came to the enlightening beings in the womb to see and honor him, to listen to the teaching and hear his discourse. Yet even though it took in all those multitudes, my belly was not enlarged. Nor did this body of mine become any more than a human body. So this is the main teaching of the Avatamsaka Sutra. I mean, you lose track of it sometimes in the vastness of it all, but it's saying that all of this vastness is in the ordinary human body. So that every woman who gives birth, this is what is going on there. There's no limit to the size of the person's womb with the baby in it, even though it appears to be, in this world, an ordinary human body. Why was this? Because of the development of this enlightening liberation of the magic knowledge of great vows. So the magic here is the great vow to awaken. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to share with you tonight. And I know, I'm aware that we have two readers who are going to read some parts of the sutra before we have our groups. And wouldn't you know it, after talking about Maya, guess who the first reader is? Maya. Can you imagine that? Maya, we actually have Maya in our Sangha. Can you believe it? Other sanghas, watch out. We're the only ones who actually have Maya in our sangha, the real Maya. And she's going to read some part of the sutra first, and then Denise. And I think then maybe there's somebody else, but I know we have those too. So, Maya, you go ahead.
Okay, we do have another Maya, Pearl and Nick's daughter.
That's right, that's right. We have Maya, that's right. We have two Mayas, of course we do. Yeah. No pressure. No pressure on the young Maya. No pressure on her. No. Let's not tell her about this, okay? Let's not tell her. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Maya.
So I've chosen to read number 50, and I will try and pronounce their names. And I chose it. I think I'll tell you why I chose it before I read it.